Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Matt Parker.
I'm Steve Mould.
I'm Helen Arney, and this is another podcast of Unnecessary Detail.
If you're unfamiliar with it, it is, well, it's Unnecessary Detail in podcast form.
The unifying theme for this episode is stick.
Yes, I'm going to be trying to tie a knot using sticks.
I will be finding out why certain things get stuck in my daughter's head.
And I will be getting stuck repeatedly.
Yep, without any help from us.
So I had this advert that I remember as a kid back in the 80s for Fairy Liquid. And it was like, you know, we're going to compare this Fairy Liquid to the best rival brand. And look how many more dishes you can clean with a bottle of Fairy Liquid. Is Fairy Liquid getting this dish clean versus the rival brand? Press your finger into the dish and pull it down on the plate and it creates this squeaky sound. If you're listening in America, Ajax ran similar adverts where they focused on the squeakiness of the dish.
Yeah, I hated those adverts because I really hate that squeaky noise. I'd have to leave the room and switch off because it was like, like nails down a blackboard.
It's funny you should say nails down a blackboard because I think it's a similar thing going on. But for me, the story is interesting of how this particular thing makes this particular sound. But first, we need to talk about where does sound come from anyway? Helen, you're a sound person, so you know this, but it's caused by things that vibrate, right?
Yeah, that's basically it.
So, well, it has to vibrate fast enough, right? So like anything that vibrates more than, say, 20 times a second, that's something that we can hear. It's very, very low pitch. We can hear up to something that vibrates 20,000 times a second thereabouts, and that's something that's really high pitch. And then you've got all these different pitches in between. So for example, if you pluck a guitar string, that causes the guitar string to move backwards and forwards. And that backwards and forwards motion of the string pushes against the air that's in front of it. So you get these pressure waves traveling through the air. They spread outwards from the string. It's a bit more complicated than that because it's amplified by the body of the guitar, but let's just imagine the string for now. This pressure wave is emanating from the string. It reaches your ears and your ears detect that as sound. But it turns out, actually, if you want to understand how a squeaky clean plate or scraping nails down a blackboard works, a guitar isn't that instructive. Actually, the more instructive instrument would be a violin. The reason it makes more sense to look at violins instead of guitars is because violins work through friction. So friction is the force that stops you from sliding two objects together. But importantly, there are two different types of friction. There's static friction. That's the force you feel before anything's moved. So you press two objects together, you try and slide them against each other, and you can't. They won't move. And it's static friction that's stopping you from moving those two objects together. Once you get them moving, it's now kinetic friction. So when they're moving, it's kinetic friction. When they're not moving, it's static friction. The key thing is kinetic friction is lower than static friction. So the way a violin works, and Helen, you're not going to like my simplification because you're a musical person and I'm all about the physics at this point, but you rest the bow on the string and then you start to drag the bow across the string. But let's look at this in minute detail. So when you first start to drag the bow across, the string is actually stuck to the bow with static friction. So the bow is actually pulling the string away from equilibrium. And as the string moves further and further away from equilibrium, the force that's trying to restore the string back to equilibrium is getting greater and greater and greater. And eventually, that restoring force is going to overcome static friction. The string is going to become unstuck from the bow.
You're basically twanging a string in like 200 words. Yeah?
Repeatedly twanging.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you are repeatedly. Well, it's a bit like when you pluck a guitar string with your finger, you're hooking your finger over the string, but with a violin bow, it's static friction that's doing the plucking. That makes sense, right? Doesn't it?
High-speed multi-plucks, yeah.
So once the string is released, it's experiencing kinetic friction, which is much, much lower in this case. It's essentially a free-moving string. And how fast the string moves is defined by the tension in the string, the mass of the string, all those sorts of things. Once it gets all the way, it's going to travel past equilibrium and it's going to reach the maximum on the other side. And at that point, it gets restuck onto the bow. And then it's being dragged by the bow all the way across and it gets released again from static friction. And so you've got this repeated motion, and the physical properties of the string define the resonating frequency of that string. So the frequency you end up with is the natural resonating frequency of that string when you drag the bow across it. And in the case of the A string of a violin, that's 440 times per second.
So you've got a violin, it's got an A string, which plays an A, which is vibrating at 440 times a second. You're basically using the bow to repeatedly pluck the string using friction so that it plays the note that it's supposed to be playing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, another way of looking at it is the bow is simply topping up the energy of the string. So whenever this happens, it's called stick slip phenomena.
Ah, there we are.
You see stick slip phenomena everywhere. A squeaky door hinge is stick slip phenomena. Whenever you can hear it, it's because the thing is sticking and slipping at an audible frequency. My favorite example, do you know what the slowest stick slip is? Or at least the slowest that I know of?
Really big sports shoes on a basketball court.
Yeah, so sports shoes on a basketball court.
Like clown-sized sports shoes on a basketball court.
I'm not sure that experiment has ever been done. The slowest example is earthquakes.
Oh.
So most of the time, two continents are experiencing static friction. And then every so often, the force of the two continents trying to slide against each other will overcome static friction and you'll get a sudden slip. And that's an earthquake.
And chalk.
Chalk.
Well, okay, so you get the noise when you run your fingers or nails down a chalkboard, but experts at writing with chalk can draw a dotted line at high speed, which is often required when doing maths at some rate, by just the right pressure, you'll get what I now assume is the stick and slip of the chalk kind of just bouncing across the surface of the chalkboard.
Oh, that's nice. Ooh. Yeah, I think I've seen videos of that, and it never occurred to me that would be stick slip. But yeah, it must be.
Feels like it.
That's an amazing mathematician pro skill as well. Is that the kind of thing you practice?
Oh, yeah. That's the one thing that unites professional level gymnasts and mathematicians. Important chalk work.
So the amazing thing is when you draw your finger down a clean plate, it's the skin on your finger that's vibrating backwards and forwards.
Not the plate.
What?
Not the plate, no. Like if you ping a plate, you'll get a note, but it won't be the same note as when you drag your finger across the plate.
Is that why you can get different notes out of it? You can go...
Yeah, it's you're hearing the resonating frequency of your finger skin. But in the same way as if you play a violin badly, you can get the higher harmonics. You can get different notes by drawing your finger down a plate by getting the different harmonics of your finger skin.
So you're saying do not try and vibrate the plate. That's impossible. Instead, only try to realize the truth. There is no plate. Then you'll see that it is not the plate that vibrates. It is only your finger.
Yes.
I've got it. Excellent.
Great. Thanks for that, Matt.
That's really cleared it up for me.
But so those adverts are somewhat fraudulent in the sense that you can always get a plate to squeak so long as the plate is clean and your finger is clean. So you have to wash your hands in quite stringent soap to get rid of any of your natural oils, because those natural oils that you produce with your skin reduce static friction until it's basically equal to kinetic friction. And that removes the stick slip phenomena entirely.
So really, that is not an advert for fairy liquid. That's an advert for hand soap.
Yeah, exactly. What's interesting in these strange times of COVID-19, where we're all washing our hands like crazy, you actually want quite a mild soap. So I often wash my hands with dish soap because it's the only soap that's there by the sink. And that's actually really bad for your hands because it's very strong soap and it will just tear away all of your natural oils, whereas hand soaps are often designed in a way to leave some of your natural oils behind. Those fairy liquid adverts were advertising that they were very mild, they were very gentle on your hands. Hands that do dishes are as soft as your face. You may remember that tagline. But actually, soap that treats your hands in that way is less likely to lead to a squeaky clean effect because you've still got oils on your hands.
And on your plates, I assume.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, exactly. Stop rubbing your hands on your plates, you know?
That's disgusting.
Thanks for listening to a podcast of Unnecessary Detail, part of the Acast Creator Network.
Please tell me, Matt, you have a more straightforward stick for us.
Well, I'm going to talk about stick knots.
That sounds promising.
Thank you. Stick is right there in the title before we even start. And, well, here's the problem. So it's a matter of public record. I'm a big fan of knots, or at least the mathematical theory of knots.
It's beautiful.
He's got a rope.
I brought a lot of rope and, later on, some straws. However, when people talk about knots, they tend to mean one of two things. You can either tie two ends of rope together. You've also got where people are like, oh, there's a knot in this rope, partway down the rope and pulled it tight. So people are like, ah, this rope is now knotted. And mathematicians tend to only care about this second type, except when it's pulled tight like this, it's kind of hard to see what's going on with that knot. So what we do is we gently loosen the knot. It looks more like a pretzel now. Now, for those of you who actually insist on seeing these things, of course, we'll take some photos. They're linked in the show notes for this podcast. You can go and check them out. But effectively, I've just got a whole lots of bits of rope that I'm waving around, and I'm claiming they're all different.
If it's just a loop of string, like just an O shape.
Yep.
Do mathematicians call that a knot?
That's the unknot.
The unknot. Okay. Trivial.
And that's just a loop. Yeah. What I love is the people who study this are called knot theorists. So interestingly, for a long time, knots were only used by like sailors and people who were doing practical things with them. And they did go through and categorize them all. I actually own a book from 1944 called The Ashley Book of Knots. And that was a collection of almost 4,000 different knots and ways to tie them and how they work.
No!
It's so cool.
There can't be 4,000. That's insane.
Hey, well, strap in. There's a lot of knots. So it was actually physicists, not mathematicians, who first got interested in knots. It was actually the 1800s. People like Lord Kelvin, they thought that atoms might be knots in kind of vortexes in the ether. Anyone got a good description of what the ether was?
The luminiferous ether.
That's the one.
It's analogous to sound. So sound has to travel through air. If there's no air, you don't get sound. People thought the same thing was true for light because light travels as a wave. So it must be a wave in something. There must be some medium like air that light travels through, the luminiferous ether. But they were wrong.
They were wrong. But when they thought that was the case, they realized, hang on, we've already got a periodic table of all the elements and their properties. What if we did a periodic table of different types of knots? And if we can show they're the same, we've managed to show that atoms are just knots in the ether. And so people got obsessed with studying and analyzing knots in the 1800s because they thought that's what everything around us was. It turns out they were wrong. There was then like laser interferometers showed us that, you know, even though the Earth is moving through space, the speed of light is the same in every direction and the theory was disbanded. But we still use the same terminology and notation and mathematics that was originally used when they thought they were going to have the periodic table made of knots. So when I wave around a knot and I say, oh, this is the 7-2 knot or something, I'm harking back to 19th century physicists who thought this would explain all matter.
But it does not.
But it does not.
That's really cool, though. So there's a periodic table of knots.
Yeah. And the way that they decided to classify them was, if you've got a knot, you try and put it down with the fewest points where it crosses itself. So it can take a while to work out what that is, but we call it the minimum crossing number. They, you know, you arrange your knot and you're like, okay, there's no way you can put this knot down with fewer than four crossings or something like that. And then they went through and did this massive table. So there's only one knot that has a minimum crossing number of three. There's only one at four, two at five, three at six. And then you get more and more very, very quickly. By the time you get up to a minimum crossing number of nine crossings, there are 49 distinct knots. And if you were to list out all of them up to 16 crossings or fewer, there are over 1.7 million possible knots. So there's just an insane number of them.
So the 4,000 in your book is massively underpowering the number of possible knots.
They missed loads.
Wow.
And I guess they were looking at practical ones. And since then, in the 90s, they did slightly update that book with new knots or ones they realized were duplicates. It was actually the same knot, but with different names and different ways of tying it. So occasionally they update that, but that's still like the practical end of knots. Mathematicians, however, were like, how far can we abstract this? Or how far can we change our starting assumptions? So in mathematics, you'd start with one set of assumptions, like we're going to have a rope, we're going to join the ends together, we're going to investigate the ways that that can be tangled. And then you're like, well, what if, instead of a rope, what if these were all sticks?
Honestly, Matt, I think you took longer to get to sticks than I did. Anyway, go on.
The important thing was I said it at the beginning and then moved on. So I've made a stick knot. I've made it out of straws.
Whoa!
Thank you. I've got six straws. So six is the fewest number of straws that you can arrange in a knot. So there's no way I can untangle this back out into a loop. But yet, you don't have to bend the straws to make the knot in the first place. So six is the smallest stick number.
Okay, I'm going to try and describe it. It looks like two coat hangers copulating.
Okay, maybe.
Or it's sort of like a very straight-edged version of the Boy Scout Girl Guide trefoil.
Well, it is a trefoil.
Oh!
So full marks to Arnie. There you go.
Nice.
Yeah. So this is a trefoil, which is the most simple knot. It's got a minimum crossing number of three. And this is the most simple stick knot. It requires six sticks to make one of these.
To be clear, you're not allowed to flex the sticks at all. The sticks have to be straight.
You are not allowed to flex the sticks. So I have used straws, which are a bit bendy, but you could make this out of like welded straight metal sticks and you would get this knot. Well, this is the only knot you can get with six. If you had seven sticks at your disposal, so if I add one more straw, there's still only one possible knot I could do, but it's different to this one, which would be nice. If I had eight sticks, then suddenly there are five different knots I can make. And actually with eight sticks, you can make all the knots which had a minimum crossing number of five or six. And so as soon as mathematicians started playing with stick knots, they were like, how do we relate the stick number of a knot to its minimum crossing number? Mm. And it turns out we don't know yet. There's still an open part of mathematics. We have no idea. Well, we've got some ideas, but there's no way to take a knot from its number of crossings and turn it into the number of sticks you would need to make that knot. We have got upper and lower bounds, if you'd like to hear those.
Yes.
Good. I was going to tell you anyway. So the number of sticks you need is definitely less than 1.5 times one more than the crossing number of the knot. And it's definitely more than half of 7 plus the square root of 8 times the crossing number plus 1.
That's ridiculous.
It's great, isn't it?
It's ridiculous.
And what I love is that ridiculous, a half of a thing plus a big square root. If anyone recognizes that or sounds vaguely familiar, it's from the quadratic formula for solving a quadratic.
Oh, minus b plus or minus the square root of a squared plus b squared.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like thinking, well, each of the sticks. Can't cross the ones next to them, so that's the number of sticks minus 3, and each of those can cross the number minus 4, and you multiply them together to get the total number of crossings, and you end up with a quadratic, and then when you solve that, that's where you get the lower bound. And a lot of this was only discovered within the last 10 years. So this is still, I mean, all of knot theory is still an open area of research, but stick knots particularly, there's a lot we don't know about them.
You know, I'm all for blue skies research. You know, a lot of discoveries are made before an application is known.
That's great to hear, Steve. And I assume it means there'll be no further questions.
Yeah, well, there's a big but coming, you know. I just can't see how this could possibly be applicable anywhere.
Thanks a lot.
Except possibly in crafting with my toddler.
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry, honey. We've only got 6 sticks. Yeah. There's only one possible way we could put these together.
Bend the damn stick.
I'd been keeping these multicolored straws for ages. And I was like, yes, I can use them to make stick knots. So there you go. Okay. So there are some practical applications. So in terms of when you'd actually have something that's knotted but is made of sticks, if you've got long chain polymers or, you know, molecules, they are effectively made up of rigid links that can then hinge at the joins. I'm not a chemist, but go with me. And some of these long chain molecules can form loops. And if they're knotted loops or tangled loops, it changes the chemical properties. And so a chemical that's in a tangled closed loop is a stick knot. However, the only one we've ever observed happening was only a trefoil, which is the most boring knot. That's not the unknot. And it had loads of molecules to spare. By my count, just looking at the molecule, I reckon it had about 18 sticks worth. So that's like 3 times as many. So it's not actually used yet, but hypothetically, in the future, potentially, it might be useful. And finally, I did use a stick knot in my everyday life, a practical application, or rather, my friend Sabetta did.
Yeah, well, no one can describe your life as normal, Matt. So this had better be a good application.
Yeah, that burn was both swift and accurate. So for a long time, I wanted to work out if on the tube, so the underground subway in London, if there's a path you can follow, which would be a closed knot as you go around, because the tube lines go above and below each other. And when I was working it out with some mathematician friends of mine, Sabetta, she realized that a lot of the tube lines are in different layers, because when they were divvying up the contracts originally, they're like, okay, you do the northern line, you get this depth. You're doing the Piccadilly line, you get that depth. And then the stations are kind of where you go up and down between the layers. And she's like, that sounds like a stick knot. So she used her knowledge of stick knots to work out a journey we could follow around the London Underground, which was a knotted path. And so QED, stick knots are useful. Thank you very much. I take your snickering as agreement.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Helen Arney, hit us with your stick.
You've been waiting this whole episode to say that.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, I was going to say rhythm stick, but you're not doing anything about music. So.
Yeah, I'm not doing anything about music, unfortunately. Mm. I'm doing stuff about maths.
What?
Whoa.
I'm trying to take over Matt's spot because I have got really interested in how mathematics sticks in the brain of a child, because I'm spending a lot of time with my three-year-old and I am watching her every day get to grips with language and maths and learning all of the women who have been to space. She doesn't yet know that men go to space. This is something I have kept from her. When she finds out about Buzz Aldrin, she is going to be pissed off. But at the moment, she thinks Sally Ride and Valentina Cherikova are the bomb. But it's really interesting to spend time with her and watch her learning and developing. And the thing that I have seen her do recently is learn maths. And it's absolutely mind-blowing for me. Because I can't remember learning maths. Like, Matt, Steve, can you remember what it was like to first understand numbers?
No.
It happens before you consciously know that you don't know things, right?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I feel like that's my life every day.
Every day you're like, I'm discovering so much.
Some more maths now makes sense. But you're right. I cannot say the first time that happened.
I remember learning long division.
I mean, that's a special moment in everyone's development.
Yeah, I don't remember learning how to count or anything like that. So it's really fascinating to see it from the outside. And when Matilda sees three of something on the floor, she says, triangle, right? And first time she did this, I thought, this is incredible. Nice. She understands numbers, because this was like a year and a half ago and she started pointing at things and saying triangle. And she seems to be able to do something I wasn't expecting her to do at three, which is she sees four or five of something and she immediately can say four. There's four of those, mummy, or there's five of those, which I find quite weird because I still expect her to go like a one, a two, a three, a four, a five, and to have to count them up. But she doesn't.
She can just look.
Yeah.
Does like the Terminator scanning. Five.
Yeah. I wanted to know at what point humans start doing this. Because it means now she started to use maths against me. at bedtime, we play like a couple of Disney songs or something. And she says, can I have three Disney songs? And I say, sure, you can have three Disney songs while we're getting our pajamas on. And then she says, can I have three Disney songs plus two Disney songs? And I'm like... Well, how many Disney songs is that? She's five. I'm like,
that's great.
You're trying to take the number I've said yes to, just add a couple more as if I'll not notice. And she knows that it's a total that is bigger than the first one. I'm like, this is mad. She's doing maths.
I don't want to choose a favorite Festival of the Spoken Nerd offspring. But one of them is weaponized addition. So I think Maddie's like top of the leaderboard now.
It's fair enough.
So being able to look at a number of items and immediately say how many things it is has a name. It's called subitizing.
Subitizing?
Yeah.
Can you spell that?
S-U-B-I-T-I-S-I-N-G. Right, so I thought I would try this out on you, Matt and Steve. I'm now going to hold up some pieces of paper that have a number of dots on them.
Oh, boy. Okay.
God, pressure's on. Flipping heck.
You tell me exactly how many dots there are instantly. Go.
Six.
Okay. I feel like Matt was faster, but it might be my bias. I don't know. Yeah. All right. I'll hold this one a bit further back. How many dots on this page?
10. 9? Ah, it's 10.
See, that was harder, right?
That was harder.
Yeah.
Did anyone else do 4-4-2, or was that just me?
Oh, that's interesting. What, you mentally split them, Matt?
Yes, I grouped the four on the right, uh-huh, and then the four on the top left, and uh-huh, then four, four, and then two at the bottom.
So you've got a technique. this is what's really interesting, because you subitize into 2 4s and a 2.
Yeah.
So most adults can subitize 6 or 7 as a maximum. Hmm. Beyond that, like I tested you with just then, you got 6 straight away, but 10, you had to subdivide it or count them.
I struggle with 6. I split it into 2 3s, actually.
Oh, really?
So even 6 is hard for me.
See, this is very interesting, because I know that you have been diagnosed with dyslexia, Steve. So maybe that has something to do with how you visualize numbers.
Could be.
I don't know. Matt, did you subdivide them, or did you just go, bam, 6?
No, I saw 2 3s.
So 6 is definitely the limit, isn't it? I feel like if I saw 5, that would be, I could just subitize that.
5 would be instant.
Yeah.
I wonder if it depends how they're drawn on the paper. Because the way you drew it, to me, it looks a lot like 2 columns of 3.
I didn't do it intentionally. I did it randomly. The thing is, this is exactly the kind of test that developmental psychologists have done on small children to find out about when they learn about numbers. And it has come up with some really interesting results, which is the unnecessary detail that I wanted to go into about how children get to grips with numbers. So developmental psychologists have known already for about 30 years that children are born with a sense of number already. So they've measured the focus time of babies looking at pictures of dots, just like I made you do there. Basically, you've done what a small child could do. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Achieved. And when they change the number of dots, the focus time changes for the infant, which means it's something novel and it's something new and they're working it out. So that's how they measure the attention of an infant. Do they focus on something for longer? And if it's novel and they focus on something for longer, it means they're kind of processing, they're working out, yes, I can tell the difference between that having more dots than this thing. And what I find so interesting is there have been more recent studies that shows that being able to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that is not the best indicator of future mathematical ability. So the fact that Matilda can count is irrelevant. The fact that she can see a number of things and say, that's whatever, 3 things, is much more interesting.
So the subitizing is more important than the counting.
Yes, because a lot of parents are like, oh my gosh, my child can count to goodness knows how many. That's absolutely fine, but that's basically a nursery rhyme.
It's just rote learning.
Yeah, it's rote learning. It's fun and it's good language development. It's all good stuff. But at the point where it actually means something, that's where it gets interesting. Developmental psychologists have known for 30 years that children are born with a sense of number, because they've tested babies inside the womb.
What?
Wow.
So I can say I've been doing math since before I was born.
100%. Yeah.
That's great.
Absolutely. Yeah. It seems like there are 2 different cognitive systems going on inside your brain. One that deals with small numbers and one that deals with big numbers. And the one that deals with small numbers, counting, is not as relevant as the one that deals with big numbers when you're talking about future mathematical ability as an adult. And this I found so interesting. And a developmental psychologist called Joe Van Herrigan has studied kids with neurodevelopmental disorders. And this is how they know that there are 2 different cognitive systems for different sizes of numbers, right? So she studied 2 different groups of kids with different developmental disorders. One group of kids was really good at small numbers when they were infants, really good at the 1s and the 2s and the 3s. And the other group was much better at distinguishing between big numbers, like, is this number of dots bigger than this number of dots? But they were not so good at telling the difference between 1, 2, and 3. So there's 2 different developmental disorders that have caused 2 different mathematical abilities in early infancy. And then they also looked at adults with the same developmental disorders and discovered that the ones who were really bad at small numbers, but really good at comparative sizes of bigger numbers, are the ones who had much better mathematical ability in adulthood. And we're talking about things like being able to do mathematical processes and add up things in a shop. Whereas the children who were better at low numbers but absolutely had no clue about the bigger numbers, that didn't help their later mathematical ability. They were still very poor at mathematics when they grew up.
That's interesting because professional mathematicians are famously bad at arithmetic.
Yes!
Because mathematicians who are good at arithmetic, they're traditionally called accountants.
Yeah. The practical end of the mathematical scale.
Yeah. That's enough sticky details for one episode. And if one thing is going to stick with you, it should be, we appreciate you listening.
That's right. Stick around and head to festivalofthespokennerd.com/podcast for the show notes. I've put some links to more about subitizing and Jo van Herwegen's research into preschool and numeracy if you want to look that up.
I've also got photographs of the stick knots that I was talking about, despite our vivid descriptions. There's also the Ashley Book of Knots and the YouTube videos I made with Sabetta and Henry, the All the Stations folks. We were trying to find knots on the London Underground.
And that advert, the Fairy Liquid one with Annette Ewan, we've got a link to that as well.
Yes, we have more links than you can shake a stick at.
Or indeed, than you can supertise.
That's true. In the meantime, please subscribe on your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they come out. And if you want to get in touch about anything to do with the podcast, you can find us on social media, for example, at FOTSN on Twitter or Festival of the Spoken Nerd on Facebook and Instagram. And we're all available on social media individually as well. Just put our names into your browser, to be honest. If you want to email us, the address is podcast@festivalofthespokennerd.com.
We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
A podcast of Unnecessary Detail is made by Festival of the Spoken Nerd. That's Helen Arney, Steve Mould, and Matt Parker. With music by Howard Carter, designed by Adam Robinson, and our brilliant producer is John Harvey. Thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.